You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 20th of January 2022 on Monocle 24, The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, live from Midori House in London. This is The Globalist. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up, fresh reports from Tonga reveal the damage wreaked by the eruption of a huge undersea volcano on Saturday. We'll have the very latest from the region. Also ahead on today's programme...
This is a great nation. We're good people. And to overcome the challenges in front of us requires the most elusive of all things in a democracy. Unity.
Joe Biden has officially been in office for 12 months. Monocle's US politics team assesses the first year of a presidency that's been fraught with challenges. Plus, a look ahead to the Winter Olympics in Beijing, the latest aviation headlines from Singapore, and then we examine the importance of comedy in our everyday lives.
You do have to cut through things in a certain way. And, you know, there are complicated issues that are sometimes easier to understand if you can approach them with a little bit of humour, not take everything so utterly seriously.
Monocle's editorial jokers Andrew Tuck, Josh Fennett and Tom Edwards will explain all. That's ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The US President Joe Biden has said he thinks his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin will move in on Ukraine, but that he does not want a full-blown war. German media reports that prosecutors in Berlin are investigating top members of the country's Green Party over COVID bonus payments last winter. And Disney has announced that Rebecca Campbell will lead the expansion of the entertainment and media company's new international hub. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, fresh reports from Tonga have revealed the damage wreaked by a tsunami which was triggered by the eruption of an undersea volcano on Saturday. The sonic boom could be heard as far away as New Zealand, and the latest reports suggest that huge waves and the volcano's ash cloud have crippled communications across Tonga. Richard Arculis is Emeritus Professor of Volcanology at the Australian National University in Canberra and joins us now. Richard, good morning to you, or good afternoon. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Could you give us some idea of the scale of this explosion?
This eruption was up there with that of Mount Pinatubo, which erupted in 1991 in Luzon, the Philippines. And volcanologists have a what's called a volcanic explosivity scale, which was designed to give people information the way the Richter scale does for earthquake magnitudes. In the case of the volcanic explosivity index, the parameters are the height of the eruption column, how high the cloud of ash, dust, and gas went up into the stratosphere, and the volume of products, total amount of stuff thrown out. And Mount Pinatubo on this scale, it's a logarithmic scale. Mount Pinatubo was on a sort of scale magnitude of 5 to 6. For comparison, for those of you who lived long enough, Mount St. Helens in 1980 was about a 4 to 5. Some of the bigger ones, like Tambora in 1815, was up there at a magnitude 7 or so. So the height of the eruption cloud, estimate roughly of how much material has come out, the duration of the explosion puts Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai up there with Mount Pinatubo, and that's the most explosive eruption in the last 30 years or so on the Ring of Fire.
If you were to compare that to, say, Hiroshima or another nuclear explosion, where would it come?
Good question. I have a colleague who is an astrophysicist who delighted in trying to calculate immediately with the images from the satellites, the eruption column and how far it had spread and how quickly. And they are amazing images. I think this is the first time we've been able to do this in real time. But he was calculating the order of several Hiroshima bombs. By several, I mean actually more than a score. The problem is how long the explosion takes. And a nuclear explosion, often given in terms of equivalent tons of TNT, is more or less instantaneous. A volcanic explosion is not instantaneous. It lasts for some period of time, seconds to minutes to maybe hours. So the comparison is difficult, but certainly the energy, total energy released, is exceeds that of the nuclear bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki by an order of magnitude.
So let's look at the consequences then. How has this affected not only Tonga, but the regions nearby?
For the Kingdom of Tonga, the islands closest to the eruption site, which is at the order of 60 kilometres north of Nuku'alofa, which is the nation's capital, that's on the island of Tongatapu, they've been really smacked by the metre or so tsunami and the ash fall. As people were living on islands closer to the eruption, it's been hard to get information out of that. Those places so far, but they have been devastated apparently, and there are reported deaths. So the ash column and the tsunamis locally were lethal, let's say, at least to some extent. And there'll be long-term consequences as a result of all this. Ash is eventually a very fertile soil, but it needs time to break down. In the short term, it pollutes water supplies and it can wreck crops to the point that they're inedible. So there's an immediate problem for the Kingdom of Tonga. Longer term, the ash column, if it repeats what Mount Pinatubo's did, it'll go around the world several times and can remain for the finer material suspended in the atmosphere for several years. In the case of Mount Pinatubo, in addition to the pulverized rock, the ash, a large amount of sulfur dioxide was put out in the eruption. Sulfur dioxide turns into sulfuric acid, which are good aerosol-forming components. And the aerosol can stay up for a number of years. And in the case of Mount Pinatubo, resulted in a drop in the global temperature, atmospheric temperature, of a fraction of a degree for several years. It could be that that has, well, that's minimal effect really on the global population, but it's measurable. And that would be the only global effect, plus the beautiful sunrises, sunsets, which are likely to appear as a result of all the dust in the atmosphere. That'll be what the global effects will be.
Now, in 2010, flights were disrupted in many places in the world after a massive volcanic explosion in Iceland caused huge ash clouds. Could this explosion have a similar effect?
Well, fortunately, much of the ash is circulating in the stratosphere, the order of 20 kilometres high, which is twice the height of your average cruising jetliner. In the case of that Icelandic volcano, a lot of the ash was circulating in the troposphere, if you like, in the lower level paths of jets, but certainly on takeoff and coming into land, it was a major potential hazard. No airliner, jet airliner, wants to fly through any ash. Fortunately for the global aviation industry, in this case, the Tonga eruption is a long way from most commercial jet traffic, out of New Zealand, out of Australia, heading northeast to the United States, and so on. But there have been no reports that the airlines have been concerned about blockage to their air traffic as a result of this eruption cloud.
Mm. Richard, are we likely to see further explosions?
Well, a colleague of mine, Shane Cronin, who's at the University of Auckland, in 2015 or so, spent several days camped on the new cone, which had appeared, which had grown in 20 years in between the islets of Hunga Tonga and Hunga Ha'apai. And that cone was the immediate locus of the current eruption. During the eruption, we know that that cone disappeared and the eruption may have transitioned from initially just subaerial to submarine. There is no cone left. The satellite images show that all that's gone and the former islets have diminished in size. But during his time on the island, the new cone, what the volcanologists did was collect samples and they obtained some decent carbon-14 dates, which allowed them to determine the frequency of eruptions of that volcano. And they determined that roughly every 1,000 years, it experiences a major eruption of the sort we just experienced. But in the weeks to months following, there are still more eruptions, but the scale of them is much diminished. Mm. So with any luck, we've seen the biggest bang.
Can you just bring us up to speed now on exactly what aid has arrived, where that's from, and crucially, does it pose a COVID risk? Because Tonga's been remarkably COVID-free, and now with obviously aid coming in, that may no longer be the case.
Well, the immediate neighbors who have capable aircraft and navy ships that can operate are New Zealand and Australia. And I understand New Zealand sent in the first plane today. They had a problem because the runway on Tonga Tapu was covered with ash, so they have to clear that first. But the aid is now going. The ships are now sailing. So with any luck, after 2 or 3 days of sailing, Tonga's a long way from both New Zealand and Australia, so it takes a while to get there, but those nations will be supplying those materials. Can I just add something else about the effects? A lot of our problems have been with communications, and the undersea cable, the international cable from Tonga Tapu, runs northwest to Fiji. It doesn't run west to Australia. Fiji is a hub for a number of international cables, and that cable was broken about 15 minutes after the eruption started. This is actually a geological wonder that there's a variety of submarine debris collapses which can destroy cables. And the classic one, which broke 12 transatlantic cables, was in 1929. An earthquake on the Grand Banks of Newfoundland let loose a flow of mud and debris down a canyon, which progressively broke 12 transatlantic cables. And the timing of the break allowed us to calculate that the current, the debris current, is moving in the order of 60 kilometers an hour. And just a crude calculation of where this cable runs, when it was broken, and the timing of that would fit in with an underwater debris current of about 60 kilometers an hour. But that takes some time to fix. And until then, communications with Tonga are actually quite difficult. Satellite communications still exist, but the large volume traffic that you get on a submarine optic fiber cable is going to be cut off for a number of weeks yet to come.
Richard, thank you very much indeed. That was the volcanologist Richard Arculus joining us from the Australian capital, Canberra. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Minutes past 7 here in London. That's 12 minutes past 2 a.m. in Washington, D.C. And we head to the United States now, which is marking a year since President Joe Biden came to office. He's faced a whole host of difficulties since his inauguration, including the pandemic, funding his grand infrastructure plans, and the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan. So, how's he faring? Monocle's US editor in Los Angeles, Christopher Lord, has been speaking to our US political correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, and Monocle's news editor in London, Christopher Chermak.
So we were all watching the press conference on Wednesday afternoon here in the US, and I think the key line that comes out that he wants to get across at the start, certainly, of that press conference is, we're in a very different place here than when he came into office. So let's recap. You know, when Joe Biden was inaugurated last January, there'd been a riot in Washington, D.C. You'd had protesters run amok in the Capitol building. The Delta wave was surging across the country. America had barely begun its vaccine rollout. Yes, COVID is still very much here in the U.S., but it is quite a different picture. And I wonder, Sasha, can Biden get any credit for that from your perspective?
He spoke about inflation, and that is sort of the urgent economic challenge to his administration. But the fact that inflation is high is partially a function of the fact that the economy is growing much more quickly right now than I think anybody would have expected a year ago. Unemployment is under 4%. The country has recovered a lot of jobs. That's the big part of the Biden record that he is probably not getting enough credit for. You know, I think the COVID story is a double-edged sword. There have been sort of significant casualties in the last month in the U.S. still. And the pace of vaccinations has been fairly slow. And there's, I think, a reasonable sense that's come through in the last few months with these two variants that the country is still very much exposed. Biden admitted that they could have gotten this testing stuff up faster. And I think part of the reason they didn't was that they thought that the vaccination plan was going to sort of carry the day for them.
Chris, just on that point, some of the successes that have been, or at least the change in temperature, the change in the picture here on jobs and so on, I just wonder, do you think that in a way Biden's sort of his own worst messenger, if you like, that actually, you know, we see these terrible popularity scores for him coming into this the end of his first year in office. And yet there are successes here. And actually, he's just been very poor at communicating them to Americans.
What was interesting in the press conference was that he did seem to acknowledge in some ways this inability to campaign, to be a good messenger on his successes, particularly also on the legislative successes. He was able to get a major recovery package in place. He was able to get a major infrastructure package in place, roads, bridges, everything along those lines. One of the things that he said in the press conference is that he wants to get out more on the road in the next year. He wants to be more open and communicate more with the public. The other side of this, though, that I think a lot of people would acknowledge, and he was asked about, is just this classic expectations game, right? Mm. He has been trying to fight, as Sasha talked about there, a pandemic, trying to get the economy back on track, in part as a result of that, but also because of expectations and infighting within the Democrats. He hasn't really been able to get any major Democratic priorities in place over the last year. The chances are in the midterm elections, he's not still going to have a majority in the Senate and the House as well as controlling the White House as he does. So his time is running out in that. And I think the infighting that we've seen among Democrats in terms of how to get their own agenda across is also something that has really dominated the headlines.
You mentioned there the bills that he has got through, the infrastructure bill being the kind of centerpiece for all that. But I think part of the problem is that very few Americans can really say what was in that bill. And instead, all they see is Democrats falling out over the ones that he can't. When you look at this administration, do you see a vacuum of strategy?
No, I see a surfeit of strategy. And it's, you know, he started his campaign for president in 2019, basically promising a return to normalcy. And this was pre-COVID, obviously. The idea was Trump was aberrant. Trump had indulged the sort of fringes of American politics, was just a bad human being. And Joe Biden was going to come back and be a normal, decent man in that office. And he ends up, to the surprise of many, winning the Democratic nomination and all of a sudden taking on the burden of a party that had very bold policy objectives around climate, around social safety net, all sorts of new spending. And he moved to the left and he became a champion of a type of bold politics that he throughout his career had sort of resisted. He's had to spend his time convincing Democrats to get on board. And that's naturally going to sort of draw attention to the internal conflicts within his own coalition.
And I think part of that route to normalcy that you're talking about, he made sort of two clear promises really at the start, which was about unity in the country and restoring a sense of unity and also restoring America's credibility on the world stage after the Trump administration. Now, on that unity question, Chris, you've just been in Philadelphia in the US. I just wonder, you know, he promised about restoring the soul of America and so on. I just wonder how the temperature felt when you visited this time compared to during the Trump era.
It does not feel like the country, frankly, is any more united than it was in the Trump era, to put it very flatly. One sort of bit of legislation we haven't talked about is the Voting Rights Act, an effort to really restore the credibility of elections. And this is something that has been a passion of Joe Biden's. One of the points that was striking, though, from the press conference was also he was asked about, for example, reaching out to Republicans. And there was this question that he had not reached out even to a Mitt Romney, for example, a moderate Republican, when it came to trying to convince the other side that the Voting Rights Act made sense, that it made sense to increase voting for, you know, increase access to voting and so on and so forth. That was quite striking because his answer showed how much we have changed even in 1 year, how much he has changed from his initial tone of bipartisanship. He basically said, well, I had to get my own party in line on this. That is the way he is currently seeing policy. The need to make policy in the U.S. at the moment is he has to get his Democrats in line. And that's all that matters.
The defining blunder of the past year, certainly in the mind of America's allies, is going to be the Afghanistan withdrawal. And I just wonder if you think that that was the moment when a lot of America's allies realized that perhaps they weren't getting the administration that they thought they were going to get when Biden was elected.
For me, yes, that was the moment where it struck me that things started to turn somewhat for this administration. Joe Biden has been extremely unapologetic about his role in that, and saying that really it was inevitable and that there wasn't anything else that he could have done particularly better when it comes to Afghanistan. So he hasn't seen it as a policy failure in that sense, even if he regrets what's currently happening in Afghanistan. The one thing I'd add is maybe moving forward, stronger he has been when it comes to dealing with Russia and Vladimir Putin. At the moment, he was quite strong on that in the press conference in terms of trying to lay down the red lines, as it were, especially if there were some major invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin. But also, and even more striking, perhaps he was most firm on the idea of NATO and troops stationed in Europe, that there would be absolutely zero backing down from that, no talk of any pullout of US troops from Europe.
Sasha, just finally, we're hearing against the backdrop of all this fears of how pro-Trump officials in states around the country could subvert the 2024 elections. One of the criticisms I think Biden has had is that his administration hasn't quite grasped the enormity of what the country, the very political system here faces. Do you think that's fair?
I do. And I think that there is, that this is the tension we've been talking about here, which is he wants to be the guy who brought the country back to normal and at the same time needs to face up to the fact that the country is, you know, if not in the midst of crisis, on the precipice of one. It would require an extremely gifted communicator to sort of channel those two ideas at once. And Biden has chosen to largely avoid that.
Sasha Isenberg there, Monocle's political correspondent here in the US. And also with me was Chris Chermak, our news editor. Thank you both.
And thanks to Chris Lord in Los Angeles. Now, still to come on today's programme, our contributing editor Andrew Muller explores Russia's endgame in Eastern Europe. We'll get the latest aviation news from Singapore, and Monocle's editorial team asks, what the hell happened to the office prankster? This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, the Winter Olympics will begin in earnest in Beijing in 2 weeks' time, but only competitors and Chinese state officials will be allowed to attend the showpiece because of China's strict COVID rules. Monocle's Olympics correspondent Kieran Pender has been keeping a close eye on developments and sent us this update from Melbourne.
A few months ago, with almost no domestic cases of COVID-19, Chinese authorities were hoping for a triumphant 2022 Winter Olympics. With strict biosecurity requirements for athletes and officials, creating a sealed Olympic bubble, the Games were set to go ahead before packed crowds. Those vigils would have underscored the success of China's enduring zero COVID approach to the pandemic, a notable contrast to the empty stadiums that defined the Summer Games last year, hosted by regional rivals Japan. No longer. With rising domestic case numbers and an outbreak in the host city, Beijing, ticket sales have been scrapped and only a select few will be permitted to attend. Political issues also threaten to overshadow the Games. The United States and Australia are among the nations diplomatically boycotting the Olympics in protest over human rights violations. Athletes have been told to bring burner phones to minimise the risk of state surveillance. Beijing 2022 will be an Olympics like no other.
That was Monocle's Olympics correspondent Kieran Pender. Little sidebar here. Incidentally, it's his birthday. Happy birthday, Kieran. Now, we're going to unpack this further with our regular Monocle 24 contributor and founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. Isabel, good morning to you and thanks for joining us once again. Kieran mentioned athletes having been advised to bring burner phones. Tell us more.
Well, yes, this was after it was discovered that the app which athletes have been instructed that they must put on their phones by the Chinese authorities have some security risks. And so athletes were advised by international groups, not by the Chinese, not to bring their personal phones in case they expose themselves to Chinese monitoring in rather longer term ways than were planned. It's part of the sort of general suspicion, I think, over the very, very heavy digital monitoring that China has put in place for these games, allegedly or ostensibly, I should say, for COVID reasons.
Mm. Now, there's all sorts of worries about the right to protest. Beijing has raised it, but also Human Rights Watch has said that if athletes want to do so, they should wait until their return. So what's Beijing said, and how are athletes likely to react to this?
Well, if you remember, when a country such as China is awarded the games, it all seems rather a long time ago now, but they have to make certain pledges about freedom of the press, about the right of ordinary citizens to protest as well as the athletes. Well, there will be no freedom of the press, there will be foreign press, but they will, their access to communications, their access to the games, and particularly their access to non-sporting aspects of China will be extremely tightly controlled and virtually non-existent in if you look at the conventional behavior around Olympics. This is going to be very different. So that leaves only the athletes with the right to raise a voice or the possibility to raise a voice at all. But China is going to make sure that doesn't happen insofar as it can. And what China can do is to confine the athletes very closely, or even to make it difficult to compete under the pretext of testing or of biosecurity. So it's going to be, I think, the tightest Olympics ever. And the promises that China made when it got the Olympics in 2015, I think it was, which are all to do with human rights and civil rights and so on, and the standard suite of promises that Olympics demand. If you think what's happened since then in Xinjiang, in Hong Kong, in the arrests of lawyers, in the very, very general and comprehensive tightening of national security, as China would put it, none of those promises have been fulfilled. So there is a frustration has built up in the groups that hope to use the Olympics as a means of making a point. It's been very difficult. If you remember also when China had the Summer Olympics, China launched the most ambitious international torch relay ever. And it was a strategic error because it simply attracted protest, mostly about Tibet in those days. Well, you can imagine a similar torch relay internationally would have attracted terrible protests for the Chinese over Xinjiang, which is also being touted as a winter sports destination by China. So the torch relay is strictly limited to China and is only 2 days, programmed for 2 days. So the China is absolutely limiting the exposure of the Olympics to any form of protest.
So, I mean, this whole thing, the Winter Olympics, is a giant exercise in soft power. Is it ultimately worth it for China? Might this backfire? And what reputational damage could a lukewarm showpiece do to China's standing?
Well, it depends who the audience is. I mean, certainly, I think internationally, winter sports have a certain glamour. There will the world's best athletes will be participating. So, half the world's population will be watching the Olympics. How much of that resounds to China's credit is really the issue. But certainly for the internal audience, which of course is China's big concern, it can be presented as a hugely glamorous show. The diplomatic boycott will not be mentioned. And if China can even win a few medals, that'll be even better. So for the primary audience, which is at home, then I think China can manage the image. And actually, internationally, we've got in these Olympics, we have the usual tug between the size of the Chinese market, which is immensely alluring to foreign companies, including winter sports companies, and the general perception of China. I think no minds will be changed over this. And I there has been enough trouble, what with the Peng Shuai affair, what with the very, very public distress over Hong Kong and over Xinjiang. I don't think anyone who has followed that will change their minds, but it will go down in the rather insulated sections of sports fans who pay no attention to politics. It will have its usual effect. Domestically, China has a very little history of winter sports, but in the Chinese way has expanded it fantastically since the Olympics were awarded. And you know, China has now is built 800, it's aiming to build 803 ski resorts and ski resorts, and has already built it's already built several hundred since the games have been awarded, and is pushing Xinjiang as a major center of ski vacations. And you can see Western companies following China into Xinjiang because this is simply the world's biggest market for ski equipment, for snowboarding, and for the whole business, the paraphernalia around winter sports.
Isabel, thank you very much indeed. That was the founder of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The US President Joe Biden has said he thinks his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin will move in on Ukraine, but that he does not want a full-blown war. Mr. Biden, who was speaking at a news conference, also warned that the Russian leader would pay a serious and dear price for testing the West. German media reports that prosecutors in Berlin are investigating top members of the country's Green Party over COVID bonus payments. The Greens have confirmed that Robert Habeck, the economy minister in Germany's new coalition, and the country's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, are being investigated. Disney has announced that Rebecca Campbell will lead the expansion of the entertainment and media company's new international hub. Campbell will oversee the creation of more locally produced content to fuel the growth of Disney Plus, Hulu, and Star Plus as the video streaming services expand globally. And green laser pointers will be distributed to residents of Sunnyvale, California, to help deter a flock of more than 1,000 crows that have been gathering in the town over the past 5 years. You can find out more at monocle.com/minute or by downloading the latest edition of the Monocle Daily. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Just coming up to 9:32 in Kiev, 7:32 here in London, and 2:32 a.m. in Washington, D.C. Now, as we were just hearing in the headlines, the United States has become increasingly concerned about the situation in Eastern Europe, with fears that Moscow's generals are preparing to move in on Ukraine. But what does Russia really want with its smaller neighbour? Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller reports.
A few bold facts should be established at the top, lest they become occluded by the fog of war, or at least as we go to air, the fog of possible imminent and or threatened war. The big one is that Ukraine is an independent sovereign state, officially recognised as such by everyone, including, it is important to remember, Russia, which opened an embassy in Kiev in 1992, around a year after Ukraine became independent following the demise of the Soviet Union.
This morning, the New York Times reporting, quote, the week before intensive diplomatic meetings began, American and Ukrainian officials watched from afar as Russia began emptying out its embassy in Kiev.
In 1997, Russia signed the Russian-Ukrainian Friendship Treaty, which, among other provisions, recognized Ukraine's territorial integrity and the inviolability of its borders. That treaty was allowed to lapse in 2019, Ukraine having decided, all things considered, that there wasn't much point in renewing it.
The Russian Federation definitely neglected the basic provisions of the treaty, violating the territorial integrity of Ukraine, committing armed aggression, carrying out military and economic pressure, and interfering in the internal affairs of the country.
As an independent sovereign state, Ukraine, like every other independent sovereign state, is entitled to aspire to and apply for membership of whichever international alliances and or unions it pleases. Ukraine's tentative preparations for joining the EU and its hopes of joining NATO, both enshrined in Ukraine's constitution, are therefore entirely a matter for Ukraine and its prospective partners and none of anyone else's business. Russia, you will have read, begs to differ. And begs to differ to the extent that it is, at the very least, allowing the spectre of a major land war in Europe to haunt us afresh. Russia believes, or claims to believe, that NATO is stealthily undertaking an aggressive encroachment upon its western frontier.
NATO is no friend of Russia. They decided that they don't want to be friendly. They decided they don't want to have the founding act between NATO and Russia to be the basis of our relations. They called Russia and now China, and actually Russia and China together, the threat to NATO. NATO is looking for the meaning of its future existence.
In recent weeks, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has accused NATO of being a geopolitical project aimed at, as he put it, taking over territories orphaned by the collapse of the Warsaw Treaty Organization and the Soviet Union. The verb preferred by the Soviet Union's former constituents at the time and since was not orphaned, but liberated. Lavrov's deputy, Sergei Ryabkov, has made several thunderous warnings against what he described as further NATO expansion. So, does Russia have a case? The short answer is no, at which I'll refer you back to the bit about Ukraine being an independent sovereign state which can do what it likes, and observe that NATO is accepting applications for membership, not conquering territories at gunpoint. And even if it was, Russia, given its recent activities in Ukraine and Georgia, wouldn't have much of a leg to stand on there. The longer answer is the one about Russia's historical paranoia about threats from its West and its notions of grandeur rooted in nostalgia for the Soviet Empire. And these can also be pretty briskly dispensed with. Because, with all due respect to Russia's arduous history and the indisputably heroic sacrifices made in its defence, no sane person imagines that France or Germany harbours the vaguest desire to take another pop at it. Russia's present position in this respect is no more or less ridiculous than, say, the United States attempting to dictate terms to Canada for fear of some rerun of the War of 1812. Nor does anybody in possession of all their marbles much miss the Soviet Union, least of all, of course, in Ukraine, where Stalin starved millions of people to death in the 1930s.
I could buy for my salary 2 loaves of bread a month. So that's only how we could survive. But the peasants were dying.
Which leaves us with the always diverting question of why Russia is doing whatever it is Russia thinks it is doing. Russia may just be conducting, again, the kind of belligerent and tedious mischief which has become the hallmark of its weirdly adolescent diplomacy. It is possible to see Russia's present behaviour as exactly what it was rolling the pitch for when it first invaded Ukraine in 2014. Ignite a conflict, return it to a low simmer, and turn it back up as and when it amuses and or whenever it is felt that Moscow is being paid insufficient attention. If what Russia actually wants is to keep Ukraine out of NATO and the EU, mission accomplished. Neither organisation, whatever their official utterances, wants to buy that kind of trouble. Seen like this, it's difficult to perceive what Russia would really gain by invading even more of Ukraine, and easy to see what Russia could lose. Lives, money, such global standing as it still possesses, to say nothing of the ironic likelihood of encouraging Finland and Sweden into NATO. But it's also depressingly plausible that the Kremlin is thinking on a loftier plane than that of mere realpolitik. Last summer, Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, unburdened himself of a 7,000-word screed entitled On the Historical Unity of Russians and Ukrainians, the broad and somewhat menacing gist of which you may glean from the title, and within the text of which you will look long and hard for the mildest expression of interest in what the people of Ukraine think about this. Maybe he does see renaming Kiev as Putingrad as the capstone of a legacy to rival that of Peter the Great. The most optimistic hope is that Russia is trying to wring concessions from the West. A moratorium on Ukraine's accession to the EU and or NATO, recognition of Russia's sovereignty over Crimea, some other imaginary victory in an invented cause, for which Putin might even agree to end the current conflict in eastern Ukraine, therefore claiming kudos as a peacemaker as well.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize to
Vladimir Putin.
But whatever does happen next, the key thing to keep in mind will be this, that it will be what Russia wanted, when the option of being a collegial and constructive European country and an admired and respected great power was right there all along. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Many thanks to Andrew. Now, let's continue with today's newspapers. And of course, Russia and Ukraine feature heavily. But here in the UK, the only story in town really is Boris Johnson and how long he can survive in his current position as British Prime Minister. Now, I'm finding a lot of that coverage slightly facile. And I think the international way that this is being looked into a lot more interesting. So Terry Stiassny, who is here with me, who is, of course, the political journalist and author, has been taking a closer look at how this is being reported across Europe, Terry.
Yes, that's right. You get the sort of sense of the collective foreign press in Westminster kind of sitting there scratching their heads going, OK, how do we explain everything that has been going on in Westminster over the last few days? And everyone's had a very good stab at it, to be fair. So, for instance, the Süddeutsche Zeitung headline says that Boris Johnson is fighting for his job and that the British Prime Minister has to face calls for his resignation from his own party, and they're translating David Davis's intervention yesterday in Prime Minister's questions in the name of God, go in Gottes Namen gehen Sie, which I think sounds pretty good in German, and talking about him lifting coronavirus restrictions. But I'm going to say, so they're explaining, you know, the theatre of Prime Minister's questions, which I've got to say, you know, yesterday was a classic, and it was fascinating to watch, but it's just strange because so many European countries you rarely get this kind of, you know, back and forth, and the Prime Minister in a crisis facing these massive questions. And this article exactly explaining how one Conservative MP crossed the floor of the House to join the opposition shortly beforehand. But I think one of the things we have to go through here is how every European journalist particularly is translating all of these kind of plots and counterplots. So, for instance, in German, they're not in this particular article. I have seen the so-called pork pie plot referred to as the Schweinefleisch-Pasteteputsch.
We should just explain what the pork pie is.
For international. So this was a supposed plot that doesn't seem to have got very far, organised by some new MPs who came into Parliament at the last election in 2019, one of whom is the MP for a constituency that includes Melton Mowbray, which is where pork pies come from. You've got to go a long way to try and explain this. But I've got to give a particular nod here to El País, where the correspondent is pretty critical of Boris Johnson. He says that although he has bought himself some time, although they describe it as he's got a truce because of the defection of this Conservative MP, they still describe him as being in una trampa mortale, which is apparently a sort of a fatal trap. And again, it says, en nombre de Dios, váyase, said David Davis. But in Spanish, This is great. This is better than any language course. Operation Save Big Dog, which is supposedly the Prime Minister's own name for his sort of fight back, is Operación Salva al Jefazo. Operation Red Meat, which is the idea of giving some sort of big, ambitious policies to the Conservative backbenches, is Operación Carnaza. And the so-called pork pie plot is Operación Pastel de Cerdo.
Fantastic. So I was watching Prime Minister's Question Times yesterday with my medium-sized dog. And indeed, we were both musing, what breed of dog Big Dog might indeed be?
Yes,
and I also think another thing that's quite difficult to explain is how the letters to the 1922 committee work.
Yeah.
So if there is to be a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, I think it's 56 letters have to go
54,
to... 54 letters have to go to the chair of the 1922
yes.
committee, Sir Graham Brady. And I think the best way to explain this, and this is possibly only understandable to women, if you've ever been a teenage girl,
yes.
you might write secret letters.
Yeah, saying, you're not my friend anymore.
You're not my friend anymore.
And
suddenly
don't like
those
you.
Are revealed. That's exactly how it works.
Yes, and also nobody knows who has written the letters, how many letters. You can then change your mind and say, actually, you are my friend now and I don't like them anymore.
And it can just all extraordinary,
blow up,
isn't
like,
it?
You know, like the film Heathers at the end. So, but also in Spanish, the Red Wall, which is the seats taken by the Conservatives from the Labour Party, is the Muro Rojo. And also in, let's do the French version of this now. So Le Figaro is also saying Boris Johnson confronted by a rebellion of his troops. And as it says, British politics often uses a savoury vocabulary. After the Operation Os Arrangé, which literally means a bone to chew on. So that's the red meat. They're not given red meat. They're just given, the backbenchers are given a bone to gnaw on. Here is the plot. Le complot du pâté de porc en croûte. The plot of the pork pie.
Terry, very, very quickly before we go, the day before yesterday, he looked very shaky. He gave a tearful interview. This is Boris Johnson,
yes.
obviously, I'm talking about. Yesterday, during Prime Minister Question Time, I mean, it was possibly the most uncomfortable of his career, but he was back. Boosterism shining through.
Yes. I mean, I think it was obviously he was having to think on his feet very quickly. I mean, it's slightly, I wonder if he was slightly trying to channel the Margaret Thatcher of her last days. Do you remember there was one when she was in the House of Parliament going, I'm enjoying this. And I felt it was slightly shaky and he was slightly running through, these are the things that I've done well, honestly, these are, you know, talking about vaccination programme, running out some of his old lines again and again. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, it once, because they had lost one MP, suddenly the rest of the group kind of rallied round and thought, OK, well, we may not like him, but, you know, we stay on our own side. And I think that's what bought him certainly a bit of time.
Terry, we're out of time, but what are your chances? What chances do you give that we're here tomorrow talking about the fact that the Prime Minister has resigned?
Tomorrow, fairly low. This time next week, slightly higher.
Terry, I really look forward to talking to you again soon.
Or maybe months. I really know.
We'll be right back after this short break.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
You're back with The Globalist on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and we'll get the latest aviation headlines now with Greg Waldron, who is Asia Managing Editor at Flight Global. Greg joins us on the line from Singapore. And Greg, normally when people voice objections to 5G, we expect them to be wearing aluminium tinfoil hats. But in this case, actually, these objections are science-based and there is real cause for concern. Why does 5G rollout continue to trouble airlines in the USA?
Yeah, it's certainly a vexing issue the last few weeks for the airlines. I mean, because, you know, it gets really technical and it's the real kind of, like sort of obtuse part of the industry, the communications. But 5G uses C-band, and C-band is, you know, part of the, electromagnetic radio spectrum, which is also used to control radio altimeters in aircraft, especially when they're getting close to the ground. And these are very, this is very important equipment in, you know, particularly bad weather. So the concern is that, you know, the airline aircraft might get incorrect signals and it could create a safety issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to be a particular concern around 787s. Why is that?
Yeah, that's correct. The FAA came out a week ago and said that a number of aircraft types should be okay in this situation. But I think the issue around the 787, they need to do more testing for one. But there's a lot of automated systems in the 787, you know, for example, the auto throttles that are adjusted based on what the information it's getting from the radio altimeter. So, you know, the plane will be working automatically based on the signals it's receiving. And of course, the concern is if there's a weird signal or an inaccurate signal, it could create issues.
Mm. Now, we've been talking earlier in the program about geopolitical tensions affecting Beijing, particularly around the Winter Olympics. But it's also affecting deliveries of the C919 airline. Tell us more.
Yeah, C919, super prestigious Chinese project. It's basically their answer to the 737 and A320, and it's really supposed to put them on the aerospace map. Now, this thing was designed, it uses mainly Western systems inside, Western engines, so it's entirely reliant on Western technology even to get off the ground. Now, they came out in the beginning of the year and said that they're having more and more difficulty getting export licenses relating to certain systems because of the geopolitics that are happening. But they still say that they're going to commence services in 2022. But it'd really be interesting to see, because this is a critical high-profile program. And, you know, it's something that I think the Chinese would be worried about if they can't get these export licenses.
Mm. And finally, a very quick look at the fact that Rakesh Jhunjhunwala, who is the equivalent, India's equivalent to Warren Buffett, is backing an ambitious new carrier. Tell us about this, this Indian Akasa Air.
Yeah, they say that the time to get into business when there's blood on the street. So this new airline, they've ordered 72 Boeing 737 MAX aircraft at the Dubai Air Show. And they plan to take delivery within the next 5 years. And it's a very, you know, in addition to, you know, Rakesh's, you know, vast fortune, it also has a very professional management team. So it looks like they're going to go in and launch a very competitive airline in India. And it looks like they've taken advantage of the downtime in the industry with the COVID-19 to hop in and, you know, sense an opportunity.
Is there in the market for that?
I think there is. I mean, like India's got, you know, hundreds of millions of people who have never flown before. And the economic growth is likely to continue for the next decade. So once COVID-19 clears up, you know, there's certainly space for, you know, more airline activity in the country. Of course, the more airlines you have, the more cost pressure there is. So will it be easy to make a profit? No. But if you really, you know what you're doing and you're very disciplined, I think it should work out okay.
Greg, thank you very much indeed. That was Greg Waldron, Asia Managing Editor at Flight Global in Singapore. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24 and now are about to hit newsstands on February issue. Looks at the dangerous world of satire, comedy and cartooning, especially the people who tug the tails of the powerful. But as we put the issue together, another topic kept surfacing. Where the hell has the office joke and joker gone? Well, to explore this further, Monocle's Tom Edwards has been larking about with our editorial team. Over to you, gents.
Yes, thanks, Georgina. I am here indeed with Josh Fenner and Andrew Tuck. And we're talking, gentlemen, a little bit about the soon-to-hit newsstands February issue of Monocle magazine. Andrew, I've wanted to say this about the mag for a while. You're having a laugh with this one, aren't you?
It's a total joke, this magazine. this is because we are looking at the world of cartoonists, satirists and comedians around the world and what they do as a job and why it's become a bit of a dangerous game. So many of these satirists are, even in our magazine, cautious about showing their faces. You know, we have one gentleman who's chosen to hold a newspaper in front of his face because these people are at risk. They're tweaking the tails of authority, but they're also wading into issues of our time, social issues, religious issues, and it comes with some inherent danger. Now, some of these things are just social concerns. You know, if you're a comedian in the Middle East, it's not that you're going to be saying anything that dangerous, but there's just no appetite for saying anything against, you know, the ruling family, for example. So it's looking at these people and how they navigate all these things and hopefully having one or two smiles along the way.
Well, Josh, it's funny, isn't it? After the last couple of years, you could argue that it's never been more important or urgent to have a laugh, find some levity. But Andrew's exactly right, isn't it? It's become an increasingly fraught path to follow. How did you and the rest of the team go about, well, tracking that tricky course? Because it's not just a laugh. There's potentially some really serious consequences to it.
I mean, it's got to tread that line, hasn't it, always? You know, mirth can be as meaningful as anger, but anger seems to be the currency with which people do things often. So unpacking the way that humour works was the idea behind the issue. One of Andrew's many strokes of genius in this issue was to think of a feature in which we asked people who were notoriously unsmiling in their professional capacity, perhaps, to tell us a joke. And I think one of the most telling things about that, you know, if you're asking a secretary general or a CEO who's a very responsible person, to tell you a joke, sometimes people don't want to risk it. You get a funny message back from their press person saying, oh, he's too busy.
Too busy to what? He's too serious.
Yeah, he's too serious as well. But also perhaps, you know, doesn't want to be blindsided. And, you know, what you can say and what you can't say is a real theme that kind of weaves its way through the issue, I think, in a more interesting way even than we had thought it would do.
Completely. And you know, it's funny that even within the office... Now, our office is quite funny, but we have talked about where can you tell a joke these days? And I've written a piece in recent days for the Monocle Minute, which is about this idea that actually what's happened is that we've all become a bit nervous about telling jokes because we think we're going to offend somebody and lose our jobs. But what's strange is that while people will literally not tell you a knock-knock joke, what they will do is they will quote verbatim the most foul-mouthed tirade from, say, Ricky Gervais. And somehow that's fine. They can use the C word and whatever they like because they're quoting somebody else. So this outsourcing of humour, and why that's a bit dangerous, you know, it's if you are a politician, it's good if you can make your opponent smile every now and then. If you're in a business meeting, things are grim. Sometimes someone cracks a joke and it changes the mood. So I think we underestimate the power and value of humour if we just kind of say, OK, it's not something I can get involved in.
Well, we'll gauge the power of jokes because I will get you both to maybe volunteer a one-liner or a Shaggy Dog story in a moment. But just quickly on Josh, I guess, what's the sort of Monocle stance? Because we're not afraid to be a little provocative. What do we talk about? Quiet provocations, this sort of thing. But, you know, are we there to antagonise? I don't think so, but that has a role as well, isn't it? What's the sort of house position on how you use humour when you should push people a little bit, maybe make people a bit uncomfortable even? It's not maybe what our readers...
Is this a joke question? No, you've just answered it.
No, but how do you strike the balance? Because you want a bit of edge, but you don't want to make people uncomfortable.
I think people come to the magazine for our perspective, and in offering a perspective that is global, that is informed, you do have to cut through things in a certain way. And, you know, there are complicated issues that are sometimes easier to understand if you can approach them with a little bit of humour, not take everything so utterly seriously. It's not about knocking people's noses out of joint at all, but it is about, I think, acknowledging that humour is free, that it's persuasive, and that it can be political as well as ridiculous and funny and a bit of a carry-on. And, you know, it's not just saying what these comedians do and, you know, repeating in print the jokes that they make. It's about explaining who they are and how they fit into these complex systems as well. So I think you leave the magazine hopefully with having seen some mirth and some humour and some fun, but also understanding the people who make a whole career out of that and who make a career out of, you know, taking a stance sometimes and just delivering a one-liner at others.
Maybe taking some risks as well. Let's have a sort of Rowan and Martin's laugh in. Andrew, do you have a favourite joke that someone submitted? Or one of your own, perhaps? A little zinger? You tell them around the office. I won't repeat them now, of course, but...
No, but I will tell you a true story. I went to a zoo the other day and it only had one animal, a dog, in there. It was a shih tzu.
Josh Fenner, follow that if
no,
you dare.
You're looking at me. They say it's all about the delivery. This is just a question really for both of you. What's a foot long and slippery? Careful how you answer. Careful.
I don't know.
A slipper.
Oh, yeah,
the groan. The groan of acceptance.
No, the groan is good on jokes like that. Do you want to hear my one?
Go on.
Why did the Roman emperor's wife hate playing hide and seek?
I don't know.
Because wherever she hid, Julius Caesar.
Oh.
Hi-ho! No?
Yeah,
very good.
Easy,
very good.
So that's going to be the new one-liner show coming soon to Monocle 24, hosted by Andrew Tuck. No, I joke, of course. It's the imminent issue of Monocle magazine. The February issue is on newsstands, Josh, I believe, on Thursday the 27th.
That's right.
Get your copy there. Georgina, always serious, but always with a playful smile on your face. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Tom. That was Tom Edwards, Andrew Tuck and Josh Fennett. And if it's satire that you love, do go to Meet the Writers on our website, where you can find an interview with Ian Hislop, who is the editor of Britain's only satirical magazine, Private Eye. And he tells us all about the difficulties of putting together an organ like that. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Rhys James and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. And our studio manager, Chris Ablakwa. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing is live at midday in London with Tom Edwards. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.